I've been running the Chasing Earhart project for a long time now. So long that I can't really remember what my life felt like before it. One of the benefits of doing what I do is I get the privilege of being introduced to people that I'm now proud to call friends. A certain rec site out at Buca has been talked about heavily, especially in recent weeks. Tonight, a powerful voice re-enters the conversation in a return to this show that is nothing short of inspiring. I'm calling this now. Jill Myers is going to be directly linked to the recovery of Amelia Earhart's airplane. And if there's any doubt in that statement for you after tonight, there won't be. This is Jill Myers. Miss Jill Myers, the one and only. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me again, Chris. It's such an honor and pleasure.
Well, it really is. Usually for this show, I start out by asking my guests to tell me about their education, their professional background. Tonight, we're not going to do any of that. I'm going to link the first conversation we had in the show notes so people can grasp the foundation. But I have a feeling that after tonight, people will have a really good idea about our friendship and the place of authority from which you speak. So, instead of starting like I normally do, I'm going to start by making not really a confession, because I'm happy to say this, but more of a declaration, okay? With the lone exception of my wife, Vanessa, who has been there with me through all of it, there's only one person that has played as big a role in the success of everything I've done, and that person is you. Now, I know you know this, but we're going to talk about this publicly. Now, in case listeners... obviously, they're going to have no idea what I'm talking about here. So I'm going to lay out all the ways that you popped in and out of every major milestone that we've achieved for Chasing Earhart, for Vanished, for the book along the way. We'll start the conversation off like that. We first met when you stepped into the picture mid-negotiation to help us bring Shasta Ways into the fold for Chasing Earhart. And we recorded an episode with her that's really good. And I'll link that in the show notes. We also recorded a piece with you during the show's original run, and that will also be in the show notes tonight. Now, I came calling again for the Chasing Earhart discussion panel back in 2018, and my idea really was to bring both Shasta and Abby, astronaut Abby for those listening who know the show, I wanted to bring them together under the guise of Earhart's legacy. Now Shasta, for those who don't know, commands five figures probably for speaking engagements. But because of you though, she donated her time on her birthday weekend to come out to Atchison and be with us for the festival. Now, if you're listening to the conversation tonight, you're hearing this opening, and you're thinking, okay, pretty deep connection, I got more. Now, we're getting into Buca tonight for sure. I'm not going to let you get away without discussing Buca. We're going to go hard on that. But most people probably don't realize that without you, the first trailer that we cut that was everywhere, Fox News, all that, wouldn't have happened. You were instrumental in the PR for that campaign. You were behind the scenes. You were grinding really hard. You helped us arrange the shooting for a lot of the interview footage in that trailer. And you stepped in front of the cameras to publicly support Project Blue Angel, Bill Snavely, that whole team. And that included an appearance on what is now known as the first season of Vanished. Now, Rabbit Hole comes out, and it's you that gets me Oshkosh, which was a bucket list appearance for me. So all of this... is to tell you publicly that I thank you, I love you, and I absolutely would not be where I am right now if it wasn't for you. Now, having said all of that, welcome back to the show.
Well, wow, I don't know what to say. Grab a Kleenex was why you told me to grab a Kleenex.
I told you.
Well, I really appreciate that intro. I love you too. And I think you have done amazing, amazing, amazing work in the entire Earhart realm and in other realms. But yeah, your dedication is unparalleled, Chris. So thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate that. Coming from you, it's a big honor. Now, people that will be listening to this, again, you'll hear me ad nauseum tonight. The original episode will be linked. Your background's very intense, and to unpack it is a process in and of itself. We did that on that original episode, so
we did.
Go listen to that, maybe even stop this, and then go listen to that, and then come back to this moment, because there's a lot of years between that first conversation and tonight. So instead of having you unpack all that again, what are you doing right now? Tell us where you're at, what you're doing, what's on your professional scope at the moment?
Well, it's very different than what I had been doing, partly planned and partly not. Mm-hmm. So I moved to Albuquerque almost 5 years ago, Albuquerque, New Mexico, which I love dearly. And at the time, I was deep into my own consulting business, doing management consulting for aviation and aerospace clients, both companies and nonprofits all over the world, actually. Mm-hmm. And I moved here on a really awesome project that went bye-bye during COVID, as a lot of aviation things did. So I struggled to actually, to be honest, find income for quite a while. So I ended up taking a job just 5 months ago or so, in July, for an engineering services company that is based in your area, Lenexa, Kansas.
Very cool.
With an office in Saginaw, Michigan, both similarly sized, 30 to 40 people. Mm-hmm. Maybe more. I'm sorry, a little more. And then there's a tiny, tiny little Albuquerque office of this company. And they hired me in July to do a couple of things. I am officially the director of the government operations, and they define government operations. Well, let me back up. So the company's called Genuine, G-E-N-U-E-N. And what Genuine does is provides engineering services, primarily focusing on automated test systems, providing either test equipment or supporting testing. And they have three, what I will call primary market areas they support all over the U.S. One is aerospace. Mm-hmm. Second is transportation, which has a bunch of little things in it. And national security. So the national security work really is what I'm overseeing primarily, which right now is mostly Department of Energy, nuclear deterrence, cool stuff.
Jesus Christ.
I also, as of recently, due to some organizational changes and a retirement, I also now manage the aerospace systems engineers, which are all in Lenexa, Kansas. And what's cool about that is it's a direct tie to, as you know, my deep passion for things that fly.
Sure.
So I'm getting a little bit into that. And it's a really awesome company in that they're the right size for me. You know, as you know, Chris, I've been to the Boeings and the Raytheons.
Yeah.
And I've been at, you know, number 12 employee at startups. But this company has right now, I think, about 130 people total. It's a kind of a family environment in a way. Mm-hmm. They just really care about the people. The leadership that I work with are some of the nicest people I've ever worked with. I have fun every day, which it's been a long time since I had fun every day at work. So I'm really, really enjoying it. So I also run the Albuquerque office, which is mostly support to Sandia National Laboratories, the big, big, big Department of Energy lab here. So we do mainly support to them. So one of the things I'm trying to do in this new role is to help them grow the business beyond just, you know, there's a lot of other government things, and there's a ton of aerospace and aviation in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. That I'm going to try to get connected with through my having my Genuine corporate hat on. So that's what I'm doing now. I technically still have my consulting business open, but I have no clients right now. You and I have really not talked a lot about this, and we can if you want, but I also continue to and have worked for the last almost 5 years supporting a state legislator as her constituent services director, assistant, event planner, event photographer. She's a total rock star. She's the only certified aviation and space attorney in the entire state of New Mexico. And she got elected to her first term in the state legislature at the age of 35, just not long ago. So she is incredible. And New Mexico is the only state that doesn't pay legislators any salary. You know, they think it's the dark ages here still. So, you know, she runs her own law firm. She has a, you know, a family, and she's a legislator, which is no kidding, a full-time year-round job here. So we met and became friends. And then she hired me in the summer of 2019 to sort of help her manage her life and choreograph everything. And now I handle constituent stuff, but it's a ton of fun. I do it on the side.
Yeah.
It's really rewarding to be able to help people at this sort of grassroots state level. So that's all of what I'm currently doing.
Good Lord. All right. So now that we've caught up a little bit and we know kind of where you're at right now, I can hear people seething because everybody wants me to talk about Buca. And when I had you on the show originally, we hadn't talked about that because we hadn't gotten there yet.
Correct.
Now, again, there's a lot of years that have passed behind the scenes. By the time this episode drops, audiences will have heard from me ad nauseum. They will have heard from Bill Snavely. They will have heard from Dick Spink. They will have heard from maybe Jim Hayton and some of the other major players involved in Buca 3. I know you've been listening, But I also know that you've got, as you just said, an awful lot on your plate, and you can't be everywhere. So as we gear up for Buka 3, I wonder if you can just tell me a little of your side regarding the time you spent on that project and what you think of all these new developments that I guess for us aren't so new in the inner circle, because you are one of the people that are privy to some of the stuff that we have been recently talking about for the first time publicly.
Yes.
It's all public. It's all out there. The floor is yours. Let's get into it.
So it was because of you, of course, that I got involved in Buka in the first place. You know, connected me to Bill in the very beginning. And I'll just say that I am beyond excited about Buka 3 because for those that, you know, haven't been keeping up, it's been super, super important for the team to get back there before there's no wreckage left, right?
Yeah.
Between the weather that happens in that area, the underwater currents, the earthquakes, the fact that it's supposedly sitting at quite a steep angle at the edge of a ridge and could fall off at some point if it hasn't. So, you know, I've been saying to Bill for a long time, you know, you need to get back out there with a bigger crew, with better equipment, et cetera. So the fact that that is in work and in the plan, I understand if I'm incorrect, please correct me. I understand it's pretty much revolving around getting funding now, right? To actually get
it is
a crowd out there. Yeah,
it is.
The whole Buka thing was fascinating to me because, you know, as people who do follow you, Chris, have heard people say hundreds of times, Bill's the only one with an airplane. And, you know, when I saw the first footage, and I was privy to a lot of the footage that has not still been made public, is my understanding. But
yes,
when I saw the footage and I talked to everyone and I met most of the team in person, except for Stephanie. We never met in person. We talked a lot. It just really did seem to me, as I said in the trailer, you know, as an aerospace engineer and a pilot, which I am both, it really seemed like a lot of really key things lined up, as you guys had published, a lot of the attributes of that wreckage exactly line up with Amelia Earhart's aircraft and would not align with any other aircraft ever built in that era. So, you know, there were some super unique things on her airplane and photos taken of the wreckage early on before I even got involved, you know, really lined that up. And then the more that, you know, you all let me in and let me play in that world, once we got to the point of possibly needing to talk about DNA, right? Which we can talk about now.
We can.
And I'm very glad that I was able to connect Bill's team with one of the best labs in the country, which I was able to do through some very interesting contacts I have. And, you know, when that lab came back and, you know, I was talking to them frequently during their analysis. And, you know, when they came back with the findings that they did, that again, seemed to indicate that there aren't many male of European descent wreckages with those kind of DNA in that part of the world in 1937. So as things started to unlayer, it just seemed more and more likely as the months ticked by. You know, I know we had to wait a long time for the DNA because COVID was in the middle and the lab was, you know,
shut
down
and all. For all intents
and
purposes.
Shut down for a while and then short-staffed.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, I know Bill was very anxious to get the results. And when we finally did, it was not as definitive. It wasn't like, yes, this is Amelia Earhart.
Right.
You know, we couldn't really get that. Part of it was her lack of relatives and lack of availability of trying to line it up with enough people. But when the whole thing came back that it really possibly could be Fred Noonan's DNA, we were like, wow, that could be it. So, you know, it's all just really fascinating. And, you know, as soon as the DNA stuff came back, which was quite a while ago, that's when I really started pushing Bill to say, you know, you really need to get a team back down there. And again, I know everything is sadly about money in our world. But, you know, Buka 3 to me could potentially be, I think I've heard you say this, Chris, too, it could be when we finally get real answers, whether we can get information off of the wreckage, depending on what's still there, or whether they can haul any of it up, which I don't know legally if we can even do that.
That's a good point.
I don't know today because I've not been keeping up with the politics between the islands and Papua New Guinea and all. I don't know who has rights to that part of the ocean floor. So I don't know if Americans can go in and haul up an aircraft off the bottom. No idea.
Yeah.
As we've been talking about and I've been talking about with Bill since I was brought on the team way back when, there are parts of aircraft engines in particular, which last time Bill's team went down, they were intact sitting down there. If we can pull pieces of metal off of and potentially other materials that don't erode, like a lot of the aluminum has eroded into coral. If we can pull any identifying things out of that wreckage, especially from the engines. I've had a relationship with Pratt & Whitney for a long time for random reasons. And Bill reached out to me earlier this year and asked me if I knew anyone at Pratt. And I said, actually, I do.
Of course you do.
Of course I do.
Of course you do.
I'm just super lucky, Chris. I was able to connect Bill with people who actually run some sort of it's like a club all about Pratt & Whitney engines. And I know that you guys did an event with them online.
We did.
But, you know, I went back and forth with my friend there, got me a contact in that organization, in that sub-organization of Pratt. And I basically said to her, she's like, well, you know, do you have serial numbers from the engines? And I said, well, not yet, but do you have serial numbers in your records for the aircraft? And she's like, we can't find them because they were swapped out at the last minute. So it's sort of a catch-22. But, you know, what I said to Bill is, and my Pratt & Whitney contacts confirmed to me that if there's anything down there in the engines with a serial number, all we have to do is get that to Pratt & Whitney, you know, and then we can do traceability there.
Seems so easy to do. Like, it's just so easy, right?
Yeah, but what I don't know is back in the 1930s, I don't know which engine parts were tagged with a serial number. You know, we just don't know.
Right.
The best thing would be to haul up the engine and send it to Pratt & Whitney in Connecticut and have them do analysis. That's what I would do if it were me. First time saying that out loud, I would just send the engine to Pratt, let them look at it, which I'm sure they'd be thrilled to do. But, you know, there really is a lot of excitement, I think, with all of us about the potential to go back to Buca again. But, you know, as I've been saying since the beginning, there has to be some serious equipment, some different types of people, I think, than Bill has previously taken there. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a lot, Bill and I, over the years, and you as well, about, you know, the kinds of people that you really need down there. So if the team can really get pulled together and funded and get down there, I think it really could be the finale for Blue Angel. You know, do we have enough information to call it or not? And if not, then yeah, probably can never call it, right? So yeah. And as you've said many times, you know, the Earhart mystery may forever be a mystery. It may not get solved. You know, and as Bill has always said to me, if it's not her plane, it's somebody's. So it's somebody's aircraft, right?
It's somebody's aircraft, absolutely. And that's a great segue. That's a great point. And as you're talking, I'm thinking about, of course, other things to ask you and to follow up with. And there is something I wanted to ask you about. I don't know where you stand on this or if you feel like you can talk about it. We have talked a lot about the idea that there was more than one plane, that it's a possibility that two identical aircraft with an identical parts list, with the exception of a few key areas, took off from Ley at the same time with different objectives in a larger story. In order for that to be true, then something that you said earlier would also have to be true. There would have to be records. There would have to be something. If we get down there and it's an L-10E and it's not Earhart's, and we know for a fact that there's only one on record L-10E in the world historically missing, if it's not that plane and it's an L-10E, that changes everything. I guess my question is that possible in 1937? Would that have happened? Could that have happened? What do you think? I mean, is that something you want to speculate on even?
I can ponder, and I have pondered.
Let's ponder.
I think that it's far-fetched in one sense, because knowing aviation as I do, and having worked on a lot of aircraft at a lot of companies, the regulatory structure was not then what it is today at all. The FAA didn't even exist in 1937. So
right.
2 years later, but it wasn't around then. So if you forget the FAA part of it, where you cannot have two aircraft with the same registration number,
right.
You cannot.
Right.
Period, end of story. But, you know, could a company build two identical aircraft, secretly take off when there was no FAA? I would say it's probably doable. I think that records, as we've all learned, and as Bill more than anyone has determined after trying to, you know, talk to Lockheed, it's possible that the companies involved in manufacturing the aircraft and its parts, you know, could have been coerced by whomever, whatever agency to do that. But I think the flight part of it is what makes me more question it. I mean, if you did build two identical tail numbers and they took off and were both in flight at the same time, you know, unless they had different call signs, of course, there's no way for anyone to talk to them on any kind of comm system and know who's who. If you really wanted to choreograph that kind of a spy story, there would have to be a lot of people involved. The crew on the Itasca would have to have either known, or maybe that's why things got confused for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Navy would have had to have been involved, not to say that they weren't. But I think it would be a very large mission for the intelligence community to put together in order for that to be true. I'm not saying it can't be done or couldn't have been done back then. And one thing you probably don't know about me is that I spent 5 years working on a super, super, super classified system in that role, which was so much fun. I worked with all of the intelligence agencies directly. I've been inside CIA headquarters, DIA, NSA, all of them, FBI, anything three letter, I've been in there. And I worked with them for 5 years. And, you know, it's unbelievable what they're capable of that no one knows without the clues, right? So did they have that advanced technology and thought process in 1937? I really don't know. I would be surprised, to be honest. I believe one of the theories that ties to this bigger theory of bills of the two aircraft does involve the government crafting this, right?
Correct.
My bottom line is, I don't think it's likely, but I don't think it's impossible, if that is enough speculation for you.
I will take that. That's on record. I will take that.
All right.
You know, we had a lot of powerful, really powerful moments in the first season of Vanished Amelia Earhart. And I've said this to you off the record, but by far the most powerful moment of the show was between you and Jen. Two highly decorated professional women having a back and forth discussion on the disappearance side of the Amelia Earhart story. Now, I want people to run that back and re-listen to that, because it's not something you'll hear very often. Considering who's at the center of this story and what she stood for, from your standpoint, just how badly does this case and other cases like it need that professional female investigative injection, for lack of a better word? How bad do we need more women involved in the Amelia Earhart case?
It's a great point and a great perspective, Chris. And I think I agree with you, just because as I talk about in my own keynote speech, and when I talk about the need for more women in aerospace and aviation in general, in every single possible career field, first of all, women come in with a different perspective, obviously, than men.
Sure.
And, you know, that's the whole point of diversity and inclusion, right? Is that you need everyone's perspectives from different worlds. I'm not saying men don't understand Amelia Earhart. Don't get me wrong. I'm not at all saying that. But there's something about women who are connected to aviation and how important the Earhart story is. She had a lot of firsts, which were important. But what I've always thought about Amelia is that it was her perspective on what she was doing, to me, that was the most admirable. Mm-hmm. It was why she did what she did, which is kind of how I live, right? As you know, the thing I do in life that is most rewarding to me, and the thing that will make me cry every single time, is my mentoring and outreach and helping other young women. And Amelia really did that. I mean, I think she did it without realizing it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we find out, you know, as you know, that she did some STEM stuff. But it's really more of her refusal to take no for an answer. It's the fact that she really just had the strength and courage to be her own person and do things whenever she wanted and however she wanted, and got a lot of pushback and just kept going. And I just think that those of us in male-dominated fields really align with that and understand it better than anyone else can. It would be nice to have more women involved, because I think we just get it more. And that's no offense to any men on the planet, but I think you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
We have just more, I think we just have more deep-rooted alignment with Earhart and her story and what she achieved. And as you always say, the legacy she has left behind. And just, she was such an inspiration. And again, not just for the records that she racked up on herself, but it was just her whole approach to her life is what a lot of us are still trying to do here. How many years later?
Good Lord. There's another area I want to really get into. You just touched on it. The mentorship, the stuff you do behind the scenes that nobody ever really sees. You have collected awards. I mean, it's ridiculous. The Catherine Wright Trophy, your accolades and the awards and kind of where you come from and kind of what you've built is really remarkable. But you do a lot of it behind the scenes without ever expecting or wanting or anything from anybody. Why do you do that? What do you get out of this other than a shitload of awards?
Yeah. What do I get out of it? What I get out of it is the why I do it. I had a lot of challenges being a female in aviation from the minute I wanted to get my pilot's license when I was a kid. I spent a lot of my first, let's say, 25 years of life being told, no, Delia, you can't do that because you're a girl. I mean, I've had a great career, but it would have gone in a whole different way had I not been told, no, you're a girl, and didn't have any mentors to help me get around that. So I would say the first person I ever had that I would call a mentor really wasn't until I was out of the Air Force into the workforce and was probably 10 years into my commercial career before anyone did anything to overtly try to help me. So I struggled a lot. I mean, I did well, but I struggled to do well. You know, everything was super hard. I had no one to go to ask how to do X, Y, Z. And no one came to me without me asking to give me help. I got to a point in my career in my mid-30s, I would say, where I just said, you know what? I don't want other people to go through this. It's hellaciously awful. So although I remember tutoring kids in middle school when I was in middle school. So I started tutoring kids in math when I was like, I don't know, 14, I guess. So it's been a long time since I've been helping other people. But when I got into my late 30s, I finally realized that I needed to make an effort to help other people. And that's really when I started actively mentoring and doing outreach and stuff. When I say it's the most rewarding thing, it's just, there's just something wired in me that I never want it to be about me. I never want, you know, I'm one of those people, Chris, where when I get interviewed for a job, no matter what level it is, when they ask that horrifyingly awful question, that's, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I always look at them and say, I have no idea. And that's not what this is about. You know, and people are just shocked that I'm not trying to climb the ladder because that's never been what I've been about. You know, to me, giving back to generations behind you is so important because I've learned a lot with the challenges I've had. I've gotten through all of them. Obviously, I'm still standing. And I just want to help other people get through life a little easier. And I'll just give you one example of what it means to me. And it's just one of many examples. But, you know, I've been a member of Women in Aviation International for a little over 20 years. And I took over, I was asked to take over the San Diego chapter when I moved there in 2014. And I took over the chapter and there was a young woman who came to one of our meetings, maybe 2 years into my time there. At the time she was working, I think two jobs, like as a waitress, like hourly jobs, trying to pay her rent, literally. She was in her 20s. Her name's Serena. And she came to me one day at the meeting and she's like, you know, I really, really want to learn to fly. And I actually want to, I think, join the Navy. He was like, okay, you want some help? She's like, yeah. So I helped Serena with her application to get into the Navy, into officers training school, officers candidate school, they call it in the Navy, into a flight rating spot. And she got into all that. When she went through Navy training, she was one or two in her class, I think, in every single phase of Navy training for 2.5 years. She totally killed it. One day, 3 years after she was commissioned, I get a text from her, and it was a video taken from the bridge of an aircraft carrier, and it was an F-18 landing on the aircraft carrier, and it was Serena. And she texted me and said, they took this during my aircraft carrier qual. That was my first trap landing. This is all because of you. You know, and I'm just bawling reading this text.
God damn.
I have changed people's lives, and it is just such an amazing feeling to help mostly women. I did mentor one young man in aerospace engineering, but, you know, to help women get through these barriers. And there was another person also in California who I connected through WAI. And she also went into Air Force flight training and it didn't go really well for her. The day she called me, literally crying on the side of a highway, devastated that like her career was over. You know, I calmed her down and we talked for a while. And I ended up sort of helping her navigate emotionally through changing careers and staying in the military. And now rather than being a pilot, she's a maintenance officer and she's doing unbelievably well. She's happier than she could possibly be. It's a better path for her. She had no knowledge of it. And it was just, you know, helping these young women get through these really challenging hurdles and just recommending a path forward and being there for them when they need it. It's, there's just nothing like it. And if it paid, I would do it full time.
Yeah, no kidding. I imagine it's a natural high. My dad used to tell me something interesting to, I guess, to get your perspective on it now, because you're talking about it. This can be valuable. I would complain that everything was too hard. You know, I just, oh, it's just too hard. Everything's too hard. I gotta get through all this hard shit and then it'll get easy. I think I was 20, and he was like, it's never going to get easy. It's never going to get easy. Handle hard better, because easy is an illusion. I know you've gone through it. I know you've had a lot of personal stuff, and we won't get into personal stuff, but I know you've gone through the shit and you've done all these things. Are you someone that just handles the hard better? Is that something you can master? Or is that something that, I mean, I imagine a mental switch has to flip for you to be able to do that. How does one do that? Especially if they are struggling now and they feel like they can't do it.
The way that I have gotten through the hard is, and it took me a long time to get here, to be honest, is you have to deal with the hard first to get past it, meaning that you can't pretend that the negatives aren't there. You can't pretend that the hard isn't hard. You have to spend some time like feeling that and getting through that and acknowledging it. You know, it's sort of like getting through grief and then getting beyond it.
Yeah.
I guess when I really learned how to deal with hard is when my Air Force career didn't go the way it was supposed to go for really stupid reasons. At the time I thought my life was over. I was suicidal. I had worked all my life. You know, from the time I decided to go in the military, you know, I worked my tail off making that the best it could be and succeeding. And then when someone pulled the rug out from under me because I was a girl, I really just didn't know what to do. It took me a while to get through it, but I finally just focused on, you know, there's got to be some positive in this. Mm-hmm. And I sort of dug for it, which was not easy. But, you know, I finally just figured out that as long as I was still working around airplanes and still doing something meaningful, that was enough. And what the dream I had that was pulled out from under me just wasn't the right path. I've helped a lot of other people too through the hard, as you say, because for me at least, had things gone the way I thought they were supposed to go when I was younger, I wouldn't have possibly had the opportunity to do the things I've done,
right,
you know, in the last 10 years.
Sure.
You know, I used to really get mad at my mom when she would say, everything happens for a reason, Jill. And I used to hate her for that. But, you know, she was right. She was right. And, you know, I've told a lot of the people I've mentored and had to tell myself very frequently, if something doesn't really go your way, it's because there's something better. Mm. There's a great line that I use a lot with people. You know, it just wasn't your door. It just wasn't your door. Mm. There's another door that was not your door.
Oh,
and
God.
And you just got to remember that because, you know, your life plans just don't work out a lot. And your dad's right. You know, it doesn't really get easy.
And sadly.
I don't know anybody with an easy life. Do you?
No.
Easy life? I mean, everyone's got something.
No.
Or more than one thing, right?
Yeah.
But I've gotten better over the years. And part of it's just because of some really positive people that have entered my life and helped me a lot, whether that's a friend or a therapist, because I'll be open.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen therapists on and off my whole life. And I think they're the best thing on earth. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Having someone trained to ask you the right questions and give you a different perspective. I mean, there's nothing more valuable. You know, I've had enough really amazing people in my life help me get through the hard times just with really bringing a different perspective and from helping me really focus on what could be positive, you know, what's the silver lining from it. And, you know, like I said in the beginning, when you're in the middle of that really traumatic time, you can't see that silver lining, but eventually you'll see it, you know, so you just got to get support getting through the really hard parts of the hard and then just figure out a way to focus on what's next.
I only have one more question for you to circle back to Tabuka, to your involvement in the Earhart legacy, certainly, and in the Earhart disappearance now. You've now touched both sides of this case, and you know it very well.
Mm-hmm.
You've done research, you've gone on trips, you've investigated, you've stood out and talked about the legacy a lot with me and in other appearances and other things that you've done. If this is Earhart, if this is it, is this a good ending to the Earhart story? If she simply crashes at Buka and we have to sort of walk backwards, I tell Bill this all the time, you have to sort of be her biographer at that point because then you have to tell us what the hell happened. Is it as simple as you say? Is it more convoluted? Regardless of all of that, if this is the end, what would you want Earhart's legacy to be? If you had absolute power over that aircraft, would you haul it up? Would it be an underwater holy grail? What would it be? What would you do? How would you end this?
I would haul it up. I would send it to the Smithsonian, and it would be, I think, the final resting place, if you will, of Amelia. Is it a good ending? I think it's better than some alternate endings, right?
Oh, shit.
Because you know better than me, Chris. And, you know, of all of the theories that you have been tied to and involved with, mm-hmm. with Earhart, I think in a way this is almost the best one for me. If she, in fact, just literally turned around, as Bill's theory says, and went back, knowing she couldn't make it to Helland Island and just simply ran out of fuel or, you know, the storm downed the aircraft or whatever. You know, as a pilot, it's not a bad ending, right?
Yeah.
You know, some extra stories and stuff just, you know, make me want to cry.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's as good as an ending as we could have with the current theories.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And I think that the aircraft or what is left of it, even if it's pieces, I would love to see it hauled up and on display in the Smithsonian so that people, other than, you know, the Vega and other things we have of Earhart's in museums, I think it would be amazing for people to be able to literally see with their own eyes the aircraft that, you know, was her platform to attempt to fly around the world. And if it is in fact how she died, I think it would be a really nice way to honor her.
God damn it. I love you, Jill. Thank you for doing this. It's been great. Just real quick before we get out of here, where can people follow you? We'll have links to a bunch of your recent stuff in the show notes, of course, but where can people follow you online if they want to just follow what you're doing?
It's really mainly on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
But if you go to my own website, there's links to LinkedIn. My website is jillrmyers.com, and you can read about me and contact me and get to my LinkedIn profile from that page.
All right. Links, as I said, to everything we've covered tonight in the show's notes. Jill, thanks again. I appreciate you, as always.
Appreciate you, too.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarris Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.